From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. Welcome to The Treatment. I'm sitting across from the stars of Just Mercy, Popsicle Toes, better known as Jamie Foxx, and Michael B. Jordan. They play Brian Stevenson and Walter McMillian. And what's interesting to me about this movie and just watching you guys is the way you work physically. And Michael, I guess I'm noticing the way you play Brian is he's really watchful. He basically waits for other people to speak before he speaks. And I was wondering where that came from for you.
I think it was from watching Brian. He's a very calculated person, thoughtful. Everything that he says, every word that he speaks, his body language, the way he moves in a courtroom, the way he moves in rooms of having a conversation, it's all kind of thought out to kind of be persuasive. You have to be persuasive at his job, especially at that time, at that era where the people that he was encountering that he needed things from didn't like him, you know, and didn't care about him, thought he was less than human, didn't think he belonged. So, you know, he would make every word count. And it was a choice that, you know, Destin and I and Brian made that this performance needed to be very thoughtful and very reserved. And we wanted to show him thinking about his moves. And from that observation, it let me know that I guess that came through.
Because we can really see that in the first scene he has with Walter, where yep. Walter's kind of being the aggressor in the conversation, and he's just hanging back. And I guess, Jim, you play so many real people, and you really transform yourself physically every time. And I was noticing that Walter's really very sort of, he doesn't move a whole lot. He just sort of sits, doesn't he?
Well, I mean, you think about visiting Death Row. I visited Death Row before. It's a hopeless place. And it's also very guarded. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, you know, when I went and met with Tookie Williams before he was executed, I mean, you know, there were four guards, armed shotguns. I mean, it's emotionally sterile, if that makes sense. So Walter not moving that much is a person who is exemplifying how he feels. It's like, you know, the worst thing you can give a person on death row is hope. And so him sitting across from Michael B. Jordan, who's playing Brian Stevenson at the time, he's sort of like at his pulse is not up. He's not excited about this meeting. This is just probably going to be another person that rolls through his life. And, you know, he's left on the back burner or wherever he goes and, you know, waiting to be killed. So whether that was spoken about between Michael and I, it was definitely a heavy feeling when we were in there, you know, talking with each other. So I think that could have been a result of just a lot of things on his shoulders, on his head, thinking about what could my life possibly have been? And here I am sort of drowning in deceit, you know?
But I was also thinking, too, he's also a guy who never has a whole lot of space around him.
Yeah.
So he's really conscious of the way he uses space, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, and when we shot in that jail cell, and I tell this to Mike and everybody, too, is, you know, I hate jail. I hate the whole thought of it. You know, being black, you know, just jail is just so synonymous with who we are. But I didn't like that experience. And even when, you know, they were putting the cuffs on me, and the correctional officer who was the actor asked the actual correctional officer, how should I put the cuffs on? And he leans over to him and whispers, put him on tighter. He's a bigger one. So things like that, you know, enrage you, you know. And then, you know, it's not the guy's fault. He's just really giving him, like, this is how we really approach it. So not even knowing that would strike me to the core is like, he's a bigger one. So I also told the guys that you don't have to put him on any tighter. You know, I got it from here.
You can act.
Don't let me come out these cuts. You know what
I'm saying? Yeah.
But, I mean, man, you know, it all makes for the scene, you know?
Because I guess I was noticing, too, and just reading Brian's book again last night to get ready for this, just how he talks about going to these places and realizing it's a place with no hope. Mm-hmm. And what he's bringing to these guys, now he has to address them. And you have to think about that, too, don't you?
Yeah, I think part of Brian's journey and his arc throughout the movie was, you know, him starting off in a very overly hopeful, you know, kind of naive, you know, place of this young kid fresh out of law school that has these big ideas to change the world, that wants to, you know, he thinks, and, you know, I know I've read these books and I read this and this is the law and this is how it works. I come in here and I say this and this should one plus one is two, right? You know, that should be the answer to this. And I think he walks in and realizes that he's playing a whole different game, you know? And understanding that he has to earn trust, you know, from these men, these people who are in these dire situations, understanding how to communicate, how to get that trust, and then get them on board together. This is going to be a together team thing that we have to go through this fight together. This is a together thing. And to see Brian take that hope more responsibly, you know, as the more he meets Walter. What do you do with that hope? Let's go to the family. You know, what really matters in this situation? Oh, man, okay, I'm not just representing Walter McMillan. I'm representing his family as well and his community. So let me go meet everybody else I'm representing, you know? And then it's like, oh man, then he gets a little closer, you know? Because, you know, what Brian was taught for a really long time is not to get close to these inmates, to these clients, not to get close to them at all. You know, you need to separate yourself. Don't get too close because it's going to hurt you. But it's like, no, you got to get close to these things in order to really understand and to really be that passionate, to have that unfatiguing, work ethic. You know, I got to get close. I got to care. You know, I have to care. So I think that hope became from a naive place to a more responsible place of hope to the conviction, you know, to the conviction, to understanding the process, to knowing what he has to do, to having to put his pride and ego aside to the point of, you know, if I go through this temporary moment of embarrassment, I get illegally strip searched, to be talked down to be disrespected. I have to go through all this thing just temporarily. Why? Because I can go home. My clients can't. They can't open up the cell door and just go home when it gets too tough or too uncomfortable for them. So what's the bigger thing at play is I have to do what's best for my client. And I think that hope evolved for Brian throughout the course of this movie and throughout the course of his life to the point now where he speaks it with such conviction where he fully believes that hope. Before, I think it was more on a wishful place. Now it's more of an optimism. I'm going to impose my will on something. And I think that's where Brian left off in the end of the movie.
It's a treatment. We're talking about Hope with the stars of Just Mercy, Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx. Now, as you were talking about that, I was thinking again about that first scene where he's in there. And I guess I was talking about optimism. But he's also a really confident guy.
Yeah.
But what do you do with that confidence when you're in a room with somebody who has no faith in anything? And just, again, the way you crowded him, Jamie, I mean, just not just physically, but with the voice too, just sort of saying, this is my room, this is my space. What do you have to offer me?
Yes. And what are you willing to do to convince me? Like, wow me. Yeah. What's up? Because I've sat in the same seat, not to tell you how you were. I've sat in the same seat across from many a folk that look, you know, nothing like you, but I've
saying the same thing.
Saying the same things. So what are you going to say different this time around? Because I ain't got too many more ups and I ain't got too many more ups and downs that I can go through right now.
Because it's funny, I was thinking, Jamie, it's almost like for Walter, it's kind of a performance thing, like, show me something. This is who I am. Let me show you exactly who I am and how little time I have.
You know what? You're absolutely right. It's like, put yourself in that place for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
Like, really put yourself in. You know, we're not far removed from that actually happening to us.
It happens all the time.
It happens all the time. Yesterday, I was chopping trees, my own business, minding my own business, living a decent life. Not a raucous life, not a menace to society.
But in controlling my own life, my own work.
Yeah, in my own world. Doing what is decent and to find out that there are people, think about how sinister that is. Just for a second, think about how sinister it is that a person is laying in wait to take your whole life away from you. Not only just put you in prison, but actually kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And every step before then has just been taking your dignity away, like hour by hour, minute by minute.
And what's amazing is that with no pulse, no conscience. And then think about it. Like I would put myself in this space, too. It's like talking to Brian Stevenson, meaning talking to Michael B. Jordan in the cell. Who did he pray to? Did he pray to the same God who these people pray to? It's an interesting thing. Not only am I stripped of humanity, but I'm also stripped in the sense of, like, I got to pray to somebody. I need your help. And these people are the one that taught me who you are. Isn't that weird? Isn't that a strange thing? And then to look at Michael B. Jordan, look at Brian Stevenson and go, how do you get me out of that? How do you get me out of just the mindset that I'm like, I don't know what's real. I don't know what to think. Mm-hmm. I don't know, looking at you, you're 12 years old, you know, in a sense. You're mm-hmm. a kid, man. Yeah. This is real. This is, think about what Michael B. Jordan walks into. You walked into not prison. You walked into death row. These people are considered to be animals. This is like, I use this all the time. Like when you go to the circus and there are the monkeys and, you know, horses and things like that. Mm-hmm. But when they bring the lions out, you need a lion tamer. You know what I'm saying? So this is a whole different circus. You know, when they bring that lion tamer out, it's a reason, because he knows that he's dealing with a different circumstance. So
it's the same thing. He's been taken away from this freedom, yeah. from having all this power, yeah. having control over his own destiny. It's the same kind of thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really, if you really put your mind in that place, it takes you back a little bit. But then to see Michael B. Jordan in the capacity of Bryan Stevenson figuring it out. Now you're watching the movie. And you're watching the light come on, and you're watching like, wow, he is blessed. The prayers did work. You know what I mean?
But still, prove it to me. Maybe the prayers work.
Yeah, still prove it to me. But as you watch, you know, watch it unfold and the relationship unfold, to see Walter McMillan crack open a little bit. But he had to be guarded, you know. You don't want to like, oh man, I don't even want to get excited that this might actually happen.
But see, that's the thing too that's so interesting about the movie, is that when we see Walter with his boys, he's not that much different. Yeah. It's just, he lets his guard down a little bit, but not that much more.
Yeah, but I mean, in the circumstance, I mean, you make do, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, when I talk to these guys, and you know, I said, man, we had to just, whatever life we were going to live, we had to live it, you know, for those moments until whatever happens, happens. So they do have days where things seem as weird as they're saying, as normal as they could be, and then the reality of what the circumstances and always rushes to the forefront.
It's funny too, because I was thinking, Michael, about how when Bryan comes into this, he going to a place that's not home to him. I mean, he doesn't have any of the familiar circumstances around him, so he feels is in his way is kind of sort of uncomfortable as Walter does.
You know, when you first meet him, meet that first guy, young man on death row that was around his age. You know, they would have been in the same, you know, they could have been in the same church, went to the same school, you know, they would have been friends, and saw that he was on death row. It was a moment that, man, this could be me sitting in that cell, being, you know, roughed up by these guards, being on death row. Like that could have been me. And
he got a taste of it going in. Just these guards basically taking,
oh yeah,
taking everything away from him walking in.
And he feels in that space that I'm not in Kansas anymore. You know what I'm saying? This isn't home. This is a different world right here. Okay, how do I reverse engineer this? How do I figure out how to get what I want? How do I figure out how to win? How do I figure out how to overcome these obstacles that are in front of me right now? How do I be well versed? How do I know the law better than anyone? You know, how do I use what is right, improve it? How do I play to the humanity? What's the human connection between all these different things that I'm looking at? How do I string those things together?
I'm going to ask you a whole ton. Clearly, we have a lot to talk about. We're talking about Just Mercy with its stars, Michael B. Jordan and Jamie Foxx. It's a treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us. Welcome back. It's not entirely hopeless here at The Treatment. I'm talking to Michael B. Jordan, Jamie Foxx, the stars, and one of the producers of Just Mercy, the real-life story of
producer, Brian, baby.
Producer, mm-hmm. See? That's how he gets down. Yeah. But, you know, one of the things I was thinking about is that for you, Michael, so many movies you've done have been political. Mm. I mean, going back to Red Tails, there's been a political aspect to all these movies. Even in Creed, there's a politics that goes on there. Is that one of the things that kind of attracts you? Because it's so often not explicit in black stories, even though it's implicit. Every time I think you see a black person on screen, it's political.
That's strong. Yeah, that is strong. I think in the beginning, there was no master plan. You know, I don't think there was a real intent behind it. It just so happened to be the roles that I booked. You know, when I'm 21, 22 years old, I'm still trying to figure it out as a young black man living in this world. You know, how do I express myself with all these injustices that are going on? How do I grow in a system that's you know, and systemic oppression. You know, how do I evolve to the next level? What is life? You know, meaning, all that good stuff that's going on outside of the what the grind is in Hollywood to become a successful actor. That's a different thing, because the auditions that you get at that age, you don't have the freedom of too many choices. You have the opportunities that's given you, and what are you going to do with that opportunity? I just so happened to be a part of projects earlier on that had weight, that had credibility, that the critics love, that spoke to us, you know? Red Tails was one of those projects. And then as I got more opportunities and I started to learn from the people before me, you know, certain producers and writers and mentors that I might have that, you know, gave me guidance and advice, that taking control of your own destiny, and then realizing what that meant for me from where I stand. And I think the first one that really for me started to be like, nah, this is what I need to do right now in my life, because this is important. I need to start doing this, was Fruitvale. You know, because Trayvon Martin got shot and killed right before I got introduced to Ryan, and I got introduced to that script. And before that, I was in South Africa shooting Chronicle. I was shooting this movie called Chronicle. And I was feeling frustrated. I remember I was on my computer. I was getting ready to write this post because I was angry, you know what I'm saying? And I didn't know
South Africa is a weird place to be anyway, because they're constantly telling you how they've changed things. But clearly, they really haven't.
Clearly, they have not. That's another conversation for another day. But that's very interesting place to be at during that time.
It's a strange place. And you can't help but feel uncomfortable.
Cannot
help. Different, right?
It is. It's a false sense of home, because in your mind you're saying you're in Africa, but the way it's set up sometimes it doesn't give you that in that space. So this feeling, this want, this angst of wanting to express myself as a black person, as a young man that wants to, how do I do it? What's productive? How do I actually just say these words and just go out there and just dies off? You know, and what do you do next? What's my what next? And at that time, I was also struggling as an actor to figure out where my place was. I wanted to be a leading man. I wanted to figure out what that looked like. How can I carry a movie? I've been in ensembles. I've been in great television shows. But when am I going to get my opportunity to see if I can carry a film?
And then, as a black actor, that's kind of a circumscribed situation anyway.
1,000%. You know, because there are not that many leading black men in Hollywood that, you know, at the time people say that, oh, they can open a movie. Let's go ahead and put this movie on their shoulders and a real budget behind that can actually do it. So then I meet Ryan Coogler, you know, and I get Fruitvale Station, and I'm like, man, this is the movie that I needed. This is the movie that I get a chance to express myself through my work. I get to say something. I get to tell this part of the narrative, you know. I get to see if I can hold water. Let's see what I can do. I've been waiting for it, and I just so happened to be able to, you know, execute that, you know, in a real way. And I found, you know, Ryan Coogler, the other half.
Yeah.
You know, like my brother, we needed each other, you know, to tell these stories. We needed that relationship. And then I guess subconsciously I start to gravitate towards the projects that I needed to say something, you know. Me and Ryan, we got this brotherhood. We need to start telling these stories. Let's keep it going. He has his route that he wants to run, you know. He has his stories, his trajectory that he cares about. You know, I have mine, and there's a lot of similarities. So we link up and we do these projects to say these things, you know. You know, obviously my turnaround is different than his. It's a little bit, you know, a little bit shorter. So, you know, while he lives with a movie for 2 years, you know, from writing to directing to editing to promoting to, you know, to the come off, I can do 2 or 3 projects in between that. So in between these Fruitvale Station and Black Panthers and Creeds, you know, I can go off and do, you know, a television show, produce this, go do Fahrenheit 451 that also tries to say something. You know, what do I want my legacy to be? What do I want my career to be? I want my career to say something. When it's all said and done, I want to be able to have done the blockbusters, you know, do movies that people can enjoy and watch. But then also they go home and they think about, you know. And then when I want to step away from that and do something like Just Mercy, you know, I'm highlighting something. I'm saying something that I think is important, you know, that I feel like is important for humanity. You know, it's important for us as black and brown people. But then, shoot, when I get out of it, I might want to go do an action joint, go... you know, jump out of some planes, dive on the water, still, blow even, some stuff
but
up.
Even,
so,
but even in that context, again, like I was saying, every time a black person is the star of a movie, as far as I'm concerned, it's political. And I want to hit you with this too, Jamie, because when you, all these real life characters you play, the soloist or playing Tookie when you were here last, or or Ray, playing Ray Charles or doing this. When you play real life figures, there's a political aspect of these things too, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, look, everything that we put on screen is real life anyway. So if you are a black man in real life, a black man on screen, you're still going to be hit with the same sort of circumstance. Even when you talk about, as he was talking, which I have to commend, just listening to you talk about, you know, how much you care at a young age, it's amazing. And I hope people understand that this is rare. This is very rare when you see a person who says, I want to talk about things that disrupt and start conversation. That is the rarest thing in the world, and to be successful on that. So that's why it's exciting to be a part of his narrative. It's amazing. But when you talk about being black on film, I mean, it always carries a little more weight. It's an interesting thing. And when it hits, it hit.
Yep.
And I mean, you know, like you've grown up watching movies, you know what I'm saying? But when you see like the people that you watch, with me, it was Billy Dee Williams when he played Lando Calrissian in Star Wars, and he would still fly like, hi, Princess Leia, I'm Lando Calrissian. And the fact
that you wonder who did his hair in outer space, but that's another whole conversation.
But I know that sounds sort of jokey, but in a sense,
no,
I was like, yo, his hair is whipped.
It was warp speed.
You know what I'm saying?
It was the warp speed.
So anytime you saw us, or when you saw Forrest Whitaker was it Color of Money? Come on, man. The way he ran Paul Newman.
And steals the movie from him.
And he says, oh man, I'm sorry, man. You know, you don't have to pay me if you don't want to. I don't know how that went in. I was like, so anytime for us, it's just a different thing. When I see Michael B. Jordan in Fruitvale Station, it's like, wow, the power of that.
But I want to talk about the power of seeing you playing Tukey or seeing you in The Soloist or seeing you play Ray Charles. It's that you understand, too, that you have a lot more to deliver than you would normally in almost those situations, don't you?
Well, I mean,
this man is so talented, man. I'm sorry to cut you off, but he has so much to give and offer on so many different levels. He can do so many different things. And the fact that he picks these characters that says something about us as black men, but also the complexity of it. You're not just getting one thing. You're not just getting the same character over and over again. He's able to blend into these different roles, these different people, and showing you that just because what you see on the news or there's the newspaper when you open up this headline, this mugshot, we're not just that. You know, there's different layers to what it is looking like this.
It's
this
skin. In any given Sunday.
Oh, that's, man, it's incredible.
And that's why I'm humbled to be a part of this movie because, you know, like I told him all the time, it gives me an artistic integrity. It gives me that. It gives me an opportunity to have that. And that's so valuable in this business. But when you talk about those characters, man, the one thing that I always thought about was like, I said, hey, everybody had a slot fill. Like, you know, Big Will, you know, had his. And if I ever did a comedy, it was always sort of compared to Martin or Rock or that. So I didn't really have a lane, but my lane.
But see, I feel like you found a lane for yourself because the first time you were here was for Ali, and I told you he becomes Ali when you're on screen with him.
Yeah,
and it's like that's when the movie really for me came to life.
Well, here was the thing: it's like what had become clear to me was that the lane is the characters that you play. And I give a shout out to Will Smith, who says, I don't want to do the movie unless he plays Bundini. So then you start looking at like, wow, man, thank you for this. That's rare. That's way rare. But then you look at the characters, Wanda in Living Color, and all the characters on Living Color, then to Any Given Sunday, which was, I mean, that was like.
But it's prefused acting talent. So I told you this story, this thing. Actually, I said this to Michael Mann. When I saw you, and I hate to do this to you again, when I saw you in Booty Call and you said her name was Gonorrhea, but it's spelled gonorrhea. How you put in a postcard? You played not like a joke, but like a real problem.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
what. But because you know what it was? Listen, I'll be honest with you. Giving props to a man by the name of Keenan Ivory Wayans, who allowed us to be on A Living Color. And here's the thing. You know what the best part about being on A Living Color is? Playing the other parts. Like if Keenan is playing a part, but you have the man number two, you know what's great about that? I could lock in the man number two and play a part. And so we're practicing on being normal. I would watch Jim Carrey be normal. I would watch him turn into Sergeant Stacy Kuhn. I would watch Damon Wayans turn into the two snaps. I watch these guys like, yo, they're not playing it like, these are real people that exist somewhere. So we got an opportunity for those 3 or 4 years to practice. And then when I was on the Jamie Foxx show, because it wasn't like In Living Color. It wasn't like every show we were going to change the world. It was sort of like, okay, some shows are going to be mundane, but I would pick a character, pick a thing, and then just work on the craft of it. So by the time we got to the movies and everything like that, it was flexing that muscle, but learning how to flex it a little differently, but knowing that if you could jump into a character and stay in it, good things would happen.
I guess what I'm saying, too, is that, and you must have seen this in wanting to involve him, that he plays all these guys with real problems. So you're really acting. You're not just doing a comic turn or doing a sketch thing or playing it for the laugh. You're playing it for the situation. And so that makes it kind of a logical jump to have him play Walter then, doesn't it?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, man, it was one of those things that when I read the script, my mind kept going to him. It was when we were developing, it was there was nobody else that could play him in my eyes, you know? Everything he just said about, you know, from, you know, In Living Color to now, like the process, he was made for this. You know what I'm saying? He was made for this role. And we had conversations and we spoke when I called him or whatever. And, you know, that's personal that we keep between ourselves as brothers, you know. But I did want people to be reminded of the man that he is, you know. Like sometimes we do so much work that people can't, they don't know what to remember.
Yeah.
You know, they forget sometimes that this man, you know, is as talented as he is, that he completely blends in that whatever character that he plays, that he is on the Mount Rushmore of actors of all time. Like, he's there. Like, that's a fact. That's not even debatable for me. And another thing that in me is, like, I love family. I love team. I love being able to finally be in a position to have something to do with creating my work environment and making that a family. You know, and I got a chance to bring on my brother, you know, on a project that I don't know if I could have done without him. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, so to see Jamie become Walter every day, to put the hair on and, you know what I'm saying, and the dialect and the body language, to see him slump over of lack of confidence, of being in shackles, to see him, to, you know, feel confined in these rooms and to be able to watch that and listen and be able to act back and forth. I mean, I got caught watching a couple times, you know what I mean? There's definitely some takes where I was just like, oh shit, we in here. Whoa, man, okay. When he slammed, you know, on the table and I jumped, I was like, oh, I was watching, you got me. All right, I'm here, lock in, stay. Stay, heal.
No,
but it was real moments, man. And I'm
sorry, I have to do this. We're out of time. You guys, please come back.
Okay. I appreciate you, brothers. I love talking with you. Time flies when you're doing what you love to do and when it's fun. So let's definitely come back and chop it up.
We will. The movie is Just Mercy. It stars Michael B. Jordan, who produced, and Jamie Foxx, who kicks it. Recording engineer here at NPR West is Leonard Lackley. The show's mixed and edited by Kat Yor. I guess I should go get serious. It's The Treatment. To catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps. Or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.